To all, this is the time set for oral argument in the matter of State versus Ochoa, representing the appellant Ken Jorgensen, representing the respondent Jill Musser. Mr. Jorgensen, you are on mute presently, but you may present the appellant's opening argument.
I had my finger on the button, Your Honor, ready to go. This is a state's appeal, and the state is appealing from an appellate decision by the district court on intermediate appeal, reversing a judgment of conviction for vehicular manslaughter. The district court did so on three bases, finding what it believed to be three errors. However, the district court was mistaken. There is no error in this case, and the district court erred by reversing. It should instead have affirmed. I'll touch on all three of the bases for the reversal and explain just very briefly beyond what's in the briefing why these were error. First off, the district court found that the trial court erred by excluding evidence of methamphetamine in the victim system. The trial court, based primarily on a finding that any connection between that and the facts of this case or the relevant facts of this case was purely speculative, found it both irrelevant and unduly prejudicial. Excuse me. So basically, we have an exclusion on two bases, both of which are supportable under the facts of this case. The elements of vehicular manslaughter that might be pertinent to this inquiry are the commission of an underlying, commission of an unlawful act, and that the unlawful act is a significant cause of the victim's death. So in this particular case, the evidence that methamphetamine was found in a toxicology examination of the victim would have to relate to one of those things. Of course, Ms. Ochoa, the unlawful act that she did was pulling out onto a street without stopping. Whether or not there was methamphetamine in the victim's system has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with whether she, in fact, pulled onto a street without stopping. As to the second one, significant cause of death, there is nothing to actually tie the methamphetamine either to the accident or the victim's death. The victim ultimately bled to death. There was no evidence whatsoever that would tell us that methamphetamine had anything to do with the victim bleeding to death, nor was there any evidence to indicate that methamphetamine had anything to do with the accident itself. The district court applied a clearly erroneous standard when it said that the victim's contributory negligence was relevant to this case, even if it was the methamphetamine had no known connection to this case. In other words, the alleged negligence of the victim in driving with methamphetamine in his system still had no connection to this case. The district court applied an erroneous legal standard and therefore should be reversed. The second basis of reversal was the denial of a continuance. And there are two reasons why this was erroneous. First off, there was the timing involved. The defense did not actually request the medical records until March 28th, to be specific, of 2019. This was about 6 weeks before the trial was scheduled at that time to go forward. And the state, in fact, produced the medical records within 13 days. So within the timelines established by Rule 16. The toxicology report, which was out of state, took a little bit longer and was produced as soon as the state obtained it. Therefore, the record establishes and the trial court found that there was no state delay associated with the production of the medical records. The state, in fact, produced the medical records in compliance with all of its requirements. The only delay was the timing of the request. The trial court specifically found that as of December, the defense was on notice of Dr. Groban's testimony and Dr. Groban's reliance on the medical records and the toxicology report. So the defense knew in December what connection these things might have with the case. Nevertheless, the defense chose to wait until after they tried to exclude Dr. Groban's testimony before they actually requested any of these documents or made any efforts whatsoever to obtain them. So clearly, the timing in relation to this is 100% on the defendant. And the trial court correctly said, yeah, that's relevant to my inquiry and my exercise of discretion. The district court said ultimately that the timing was irrelevant. If the discovery request had come the morning of trial, we only look at the prejudice from the defendant not having the documents. That's not the standard. And so the trial court correctly looked at the timing of the request in relation to ascertaining the need for a continuance. Second off, of course, is the relevance issue. A continuance must be granted in the face of prejudice. And since ultimately none of the records were found to be relevant in and of themselves, there was no shown prejudice. The trial court said the defense failed to show prejudice. The district court just assumed it, and that is an erroneous appellate standard. Third off, Dr. Groban, the pathologist, testified for the state and testified in his medical opinion that the death of the victim was by blunt force trauma from the accident. That part would have come in one way or the other. The state also requested of Dr. Groban, tried to inquire as to some of the blunt force trauma that in fact the victim had suffered from, such as And in particular, the bleeding in the pelvic area where the arteries were severed. There was an objection to that, and the trial court ultimately found under the correct legal standard that that the probative value of helping the jury evaluate Dr. Groban's testimony substantially outweighed any prejudicial effect of Dr. Groban testifying about what was in the medical records. So the trial court applied the correct standard, made the correct balancing, and exercised its discretion appropriately. The district court, in looking at this, ultimately applied an erroneous standard in relation to this. The district court applied a standard that simply is not compatible with Rule 703. The Rule 703 test controls. The Rule 703 test shows that the district court, or excuse me, the trial court correctly exercised its discretion. Therefore, again, the district court erred. All three of the bases for the district court's reversal are erroneous. Therefore, the state requests this court to reverse the district court's appellate decision and reinstate the judgment of Ms. Ochoa.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Ms. Musser, you may present the respondent's argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here today to argue that Ms. Ochoa did not receive a fair trial. And that was understood by the district court when the district court found that there was error on the part of the trial court. Now, the first issue that has been mentioned is the drugs in the victim's system. The state's argument is simply that it's prejudicial and not relevant. And it's curious that the state simply looks to the elements of the charge to say whether or not this piece of evidence is relevant. But clearly, relevant evidence can go to any material aspect of a case, of an incident. The state even had cited in its brief State versus Garcia, in which the court held that evidence does not need to pertain to a disputed issue. So it does not need to simply refer to whether or not Ms. Ochoa was negligent in her unlawful act, or whether or not it goes to causation. It can go to any material aspect of this case. And what we have is that the fact of the drugs in the victim's system go to corroborate the officer, the primary officer, the investigating officer, who was also the expert accident reconstructionist. It goes to corroborate his finding that the victim was driving under the influence, which is a violation of Idaho law.
What's that relevant to?
Excuse me?
And what is that relevant to?
That he was driving under the influence, it's relevant to the causation of the crash. I think before a jury can figure out what is the significant factors, and of course there does not only have to be one. I think that's also an error the state is making, is that there simply can be one significant factor in a crash. One significant cause, but clearly there can be several. So a jury could determine whether or not the victim driving under the influence was a significant factor in this crash. However, the jury never got that information.
But what does that have to do with whether or not Ms. Ochoa's driving behavior was a significant cause?
Well, what Ms. Ochoa did was an unlawful act. I think the state did prove that part. It's an unlawful act, but the unlawful act has to be a significant cause. I don't think you can say just because someone committed an unlawful act, therefore it is the significant cause, when there could be multiple significant causes. And it's
including her and including her driving.
Right, right.
But so what is the toxicology evidence relevant to?
Why does that exclude his driving, the victim's driving? I think you have to look at the driving of both people. I think you have to look at the condition.
Well, there was evidence presented about his driving.
There was evidence presented about his driving, but not all of the evidence. And the jury should have the opportunity to have all of the evidence. I would point you to State versus Windsor. It was not in my brief. It's at 110 Idaho, 410, 1985. In State versus Windsor, the court held that the jury has the right to have all of the information of a surrounding incident where a crime has been charged. And simply the jury did not have all of the evidence. They had some of the evidence, but they didn't have all of it. And it goes to a condition surrounding this particular accident. Just like the condition of the weather, the road conditions, all the other conditions, why were they not allowed to have the conditions of both drivers at one time or at that time? And I would submit to the court that they were entitled to that information.
Now, so how they chose- your position that the evidence was not sufficient to show that Ms. Ochoa was a significant cause?
I think with the evidence that the jury had, that they were able to make that determination that it was a significant cause.
Well, you said there could be more than one significant cause.
Absolutely. And they determined-
Is there evidence sufficient to show that Ms. Ochoa's driving was a significant cause?
The evidence before them was sufficient to show that, but they did not have all of the evidence before them.
But what does the other evidence have to do with whether she was the significant cause?
Because the
jury- If they had evidence, if they could find there were two significant causes, and there was sufficient evidence that she was a significant cause.
Well, they had nothing else to back that up with. I mean, what they heard is that she had an unlawful act. They didn't hear anything else. So if they had heard of the unlawful act of the other driver also, that may have changed their minds of what was a significant cause of this crash. I think if they, when they weigh those causes, whatever they determine is the cause, they may determine there are several causes. They may only determine that there's one, but I think the jury has to be able to make that decision based on all of the evidence, all of the relevant evidence. And certainly the condition of one of the drivers would be a relevant evidence to any crash. Now, of course, the state is arguing that this is not relevant to the causation because they have focused solely on Ms. Ochoa being the sole cause. But again, a jury gets to make that call of what are the significant causes. And maybe, again, maybe there's one, maybe there's several, but that's got to be a jury call. The state also argues that it's speculative evidence. And I think that's because of the state's fear of how the jury would use that evidence, that they would jump to the conclusion that that could be the only cause or that would be the significant cause. I think that's not putting much trust in a jury. I think a jury gets to decide on their own once they have all the facts, what would be a significant cause or the significant cause. I think the jury is allowed to make reasonable inferences from the evidence before them, and that is not speculation if it is reasonable inferences.
Even if we agreed with you that the evidence was relevant, the magistrate excluded it under 403. And can you explain why the district court was how the district court addressed that issue and whether it did so properly?
Well, I think the trial court, what the district court saw is the trial court found it not to be relevant first, and then simply said, even if it is relevant, it's prejudicial because it's speculative. I don't think the trial court went into detailed enough analysis of the balancing act between those, where the district court did see that one, it was clearly relevant, highly probative, and so any prejudicial effect could not have substantially outweighed it. The trial court simply didn't go into a deep enough analysis for the trial court to find anything more than that. But I think it is significant.
I'm not sure I understand your response. Are you saying the district court didn't have anything to review on 403?
Absolutely, I would say that. The trial court simply said, I find it prejudicial because it's speculative. The trial court didn't go into anything more than that, did not do an in-depth analysis of why it would be speculative, why that would substantially outweigh the probative value. And of course, the trial court found that it had no probative value. So I think that's the first step of this. Of course, the trial court could easily find that it was substantially outweighed by prejudice when the trial court found that there was no probative value or very little. And the trial court disagreed with that, disagreed with the finding that from the trial court that it wasn't relevant. But what the trial court found, the district court did use the correct analysis. There's this talk about contributory negligence, comparative negligence. The trial court simply said, and I don't believe the district court ever said the word contributory. The district court simply said comparative negligence, mentioned that once, but that was not the legal standard the district court was using. I believe the district court's ruling should be upheld. The district court used the correct legal standard in finding that the information was relevant, was highly probative, and
any the comparative negligence is not the standard?
No, the comparative negligence is not the standard.
And so why should we ignore that the district court used that?
That the district court used that phrase, I believe, correctly in saying or implying that a jury would have to compare causes if it found multiple causes. It would have to compare those to determine whether it finds all of them to be significant or only one to be significant or two or however it does. But you have to look at it in light of the other causes if you so find. And I think that is what the district court was acknowledging, that would be the burden for the jury to decipher that information and to compare it to find whether or not there was one or multiple significant causes. And I don't think there's anything that precludes the district court from recognizing that would be a job that the jury has to do, is to compare the information to make those determinations on significant causes. Now, as far as the second issue is the continuances. Now the state points to, I think their whole argument is that the defense should not be rewarded for failing to timely request the information on the medical records. But in fact, the defense requested discovery back in November. So we have a request for discovery in November of 2018 that requested all physical examinations, all of the evidence the state was going to use, and we simply did not receive the medical records. So it wasn't until March that the defense was told by the trial court that a specific request for discovery was needed to get the state to comply with Rule 16, which frankly is nonsense. The state has an obligation to comply with Rule 16 within 14 days of the request for discovery. And the medical records clearly were evidence of physical exams test and examination of the victim that was at least in the knowledge of the state. Now, one of the things that the state has argued a lot about is they didn't have physical custody of the report, but they knew about the report. They knew about the report in order to file these charges in the first place. So the state had that information right up front. And the fact of the matter is, when the state is held to a lesser burden of following the rules, when the state is told it's okay if you don't follow them completely, that you can wait until there's a demand later on down the road, that puts the defense at an extreme disadvantage. And I'd like to give you an example of this. Once I did request the medical records directly, as I got a subpoena for those medical records, directly requested them by subpoena from the hospital, I received 122 pages of medical records, not the 366 that the state gave me. So even if the defense goes and tries on its own to get information that the state is required to give it to them, they don't get the same response that the state does. The hospital did not give me the same medical records it gave the state. So I was at a huge disadvantage.
But now, I think they're doing a discovery violation.
I think that goes to the matter.
Well, the issue is whether the district court erred in relation to the magistrate's denial of the motion to continue.
And the district court found that there was error on the trial court's part because, and the district court correctly found that the fault was irrelevant. I think that's one of the things that the state hits on, is that saying that that was improper. It actually was proper. There is State versus Harwood, I would note, at 94 Idaho 615, 1972. State versus Harwood specifically says it does not matter if the defendant could have gotten the information on its own in determining whether or not there was a due process violation. So the district court did not err when it said the fault of who received the medical records when is not relevant.
But what's the standard of review for the district court to decide on the motion to continue?
Abuse of discretion is the standard of review. And the court,
what was your burden to show to the district court on intermediate appeal to show that the magistrate court abused its discretion? Were you not required to show prejudice?
I was required to show prejudice. And I think the district court understood that with over 800 pages of documents within a month of trial, and these were not merely—
But what prejudice did you show as to the trial?
That the state or the defense would have been able to bring forth the evidence, would have been able to hire a medical expert to be able to discuss Dr. Groban's testimony, would have been able to assist in preparing the cross-examination of Dr. Groban to determine the veracity of his testimony and his report.
Where was that showing made?
That showing was made at the trial court level and at the district court level.
And how so?
I'm not sure I understand, but it was made by argument.
Okay.
But no, I did not bring in a medical expert to say what would have. And frankly, before the trial, there was not enough time to go through all of the evidence from the medical records. Again, it was over 800 pages, very complex. I can tell you that the medical records show that the treating physicians did not know that the victim had drugs in his system. And certainly that is a significant fact that Dr. Groban did not mention. Dr. Groban testified to the blood
portion. Is that anywhere in the record?
Excuse me?
Is that anywhere in the record?
No, it is not in the record. I didn't have the capacity to be able to review those medical records before the hearing on this before trial. So when I was asking for a motion to continue, I had not been able to go through all of those records. Same with the toxicology report. And I might add that I never received the toxicology report from my subpoena. I only received it from the state. I never got any response at all when I attempted to subpoena those records. However, there were other drugs mentioned in the toxicology report.
Is that in the record?
That is in the record.
The toxicology report's in the record?
The toxicology report is not in the record, but the fact that it contained additional drugs is in the record. That was argued directly to the trial court, that there was evidence that there other drugs were found in the toxicology report. And I had received them at the toxicology report at 4 o'clock on the eve of trial and simply did not have enough time to go through that report, didn't have enough time to have an expert help me decipher what a lot of that meant. Same with the medical records. There was a lot I didn't understand in the medical records and did not have enough time to be able to review that, get an expert to help me understand what all of that meant, both of which is crucial to be able to cross-examine the state's expert witness, Dr. Groban. I didn't have the capacity to be able to do that because I didn't have the time. And that's what the district court recognized, that this was not something that I could review in a half a day, that the trial court could say, okay, we'll start at noon instead of 8:30. Ms. Musser, go ahead and review those documents, those 800 pages of documents. One, you can't review that many in that amount of time anyway, but these were complex documents that I was going to need to have the assistance of an expert tell me what they mean. Because the plain language of records like that is not decipherable on its face, at least not from this person, this attorney. I'm not a medical doctor. I don't know what those things mean. I can't explain them. But certainly a medical expert would have been able to tell me what it meant that the treating physicians didn't know that there were drugs in the victim's system at the time that they were treating him. Now, Dr.
Groban, none of that's in the record, correct?
That part is not in the record, no. Now, one of the things that Dr. Groban testified at the April 23rd hearing, however, is that nothing could have prevented the death. But of course, we don't know that. And Dr. Groban failed to mention that the treating physicians didn't know that there were drugs in the victim's system, but Dr. Groban would have known that. But the defense had no way of knowing that because that was in the medical records, of course, that the state had not provided. I think another thing that is very important as far as the state not providing those documents in time to be able to properly and effectively prepare for cross-examination of Dr. Groban is that they did it on purpose. Many of the cases cited are inadvertent late disclosures or failure to disclose. That is not what we have here. This is a case where the state knew the records existed, knew at least on a baseline what they said, and did not give that information up. It was blatantly trying to prevent that information from coming out, I would say. Because the state easily could have had it. Their expert had it before the case was even charged.
Do you have anything in the record that somebody found there was a blatant attempt to not disclose that information?
No, there was no finding of that. That, of course, is just my opinion that I'm putting forth to the court. Because the state knew that that report existed, the medical records and the toxicology report. The state knew that it existed, knew Dr. Groban had reviewed all of that, and frankly, didn't provide it. When there was a request back in November. So again, the state makes a big deal about the defense didn't do a specific request. Well, the defense shouldn't have to do a specific request in every single case. There is no way that the system could support that that we do a motion to our motion for discovery, request
Ms.
for discovery.
Ms. Messer, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but it sounds like you keep arguing a discovery violation, and that is not the issue before the court, is it?
Well, I think it's tied to the issue of the continuance. I think it has to be tied to it. The fact that the defense needed a continuance was the defense received 800 pages of documents within 28 days of trial. And the reason it received that is the state's failure. I think it's just as important that the defense, the entire argument for the defense is that it's, or from the state, is that it's the defense's fault. So I think that obviously the state recognizes that as an issue in a denial of continuance. But the fact of the matter is it was the state's fault. And that should have been recognized by the trial court. The trial court failed to recognize that. I think the district court did not take into consideration fault at all, but definitely looked at the fact that the defense does not have enough time within 28 days of trial to properly analyze 800 pages of documents. And the issue today is whether or not the district court erred. And I would submit that it did not, when it found that 800 pages of documents 28 days before trial is certainly not enough time, especially with the complexity of those types of documents, for the defense to be able to properly prepare.
The district court doesn't even know what was in those 800 pages, is that correct?
That is correct. Well, I guess I should take that back. The district court, as well as the trial court, were aware that the toxicology report did mention other types of substances, other drugs. So both the trial court and the district court were aware of that.
Based on your representation?
Yes. Yes,
it was not. How could anyone make a conclusion about the complexity of the documents that they've never seen?
Well, I think they can use reason. I think that both the trial court and the district court are required to use reason. And when they're talking about medical records and toxicology reports, I think by virtue of common sense and reason would tell them those are complex documents. Well,
But nobody knows the full content of those 800 pages.
That is correct. They were not put into evidence.
Right.
And finally, I'm running out of time. There is the third issue of Dr. Groban's testimony directly from the medical records. Again, that were disclosed late. The trial court or the district court found that clearly relied on the Watkins case to say that this was a backdoor attempt for the state to elicit hearsay information. It was hearsay information. And it was clearly not needed for Dr. Groban to explain his testimony, because his testimony was simply a classification of a death. He's a pathologist. As he had testified at previous hearings, he didn't know what was inside the victim. He didn't know, other than the medical reports telling him the victim bled out. So he classified that as blunt force trauma. He didn't know any of the other specifics. So he should not have been able to testify to that hearsay, get that hearsay in, that frankly was not necessary to explain his finding. His finding is just a classification. There was no one to actually explain that information, that Dr. Groban couldn't. He wasn't a treating physician. And again, Dr. Groban knew that the treating physicians didn't know that the victim had substances in his system. And Dr. Groban didn't provide that information. He simply was reading directly from the reports the information that was more graphic for the jury to consider and more prejudicial for the jury to consider, but certainly did not bolster or assist the jury in knowing what Dr. Groban's classification of the cause of death was. In conclusion, I would submit that the district court did not err when it found that the trial court abused its discretion, that Ms. Ochoa was denied a fair trial, that the errors substantially affected her right to a fair trial, her due process rights. And I would ask that you affirm the district court today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Musser. Mr. Jorgensen, you may present the appellant's reply.
Thank you very much. I just have a couple of points to hit. First off, I think any way you slice it, the only issue on on the admissibility of the evidence of meth in the victim's system comes to causation. There just hasn't been anything else articulated here that it could be relevant to other than causation. And it simply is unrelated to causation. It's entirely speculative whether the meth in the victim's system played any role whatsoever in his death. As to the second issue, as on the discovery, the state does submit that the underlying source of the prejudice is a relevant consideration when a court is exercising its discretion on a motion to continue. In other words, a party that has put itself, painted itself into a corner is a different situation than where the other party has painted it into the corner. Counsel's done her best to argue that it was the state's fault that the medical records weren't specifically requested till March, arguing that the November request was sufficient, but the rule's pretty clear on that subject. And that is that the state must disclose the facts and the data, not all of the documents that the expert reviewed in concluding what facts and data underlied the expert's conclusion. The magistrate so found, the district court didn't find otherwise. No court has found that the state played any role in the delay of the request or the discovery of the medical records. And frankly, I resent the implication that it was the state's fault when the state obviously bent over backwards to get documents it never had a duty to produce in the first place. As to the third one, the rule is quite clear. There is a weighing process for the expert to talk about the facts and data underlying the conclusion. Where those facts and data are otherwise inadmissible, that includes hearsay. There is no absolute hearsay exclusion under 703. Some hearsay can come in as long as it's not merely a conduit. And this wasn't a conduit, the trial court so found. The trial court did do the weighing process and concluded the jury would benefit from knowing what the injuries were, not just the final conclusion that the injuries caused by the accident were the cause of death. So the trial court did not abuse its discretion. The district court applied an erroneous standard and must be reversed. Therefore, the state does request that the district court's appellate opinion be reversed and that the judgment be reinstated. Thank you very much.
Mr. Jorgensen, I do have one question. What is your response to the argument that the toxicology evidence was relevant to corroborate the defense's expert's opinion that the victim was driving under the influence?
Well, first off, the defense expert didn't actually testify to that, certainly not at the trial. And in the offer of proof motion in limine, even the defense expert said, I can't tell whether the victim was driving under the influence or not. Just the mere presence of meth is insufficient to make a conclusion that ordinarily what would have to happen would have to be some other tests. The expert did say that meth may have played a role in some of the driving of the victim. But he couldn't say whether it did or didn't to any degree of specificity. And again, the trial court said, well, that's speculative. It's not coming in. And I think it's important to note that ultimately at trial, the defense was entitled to present evidence of what, in fact, the victim did in his driving. Did he try to evade? Did he brake? Did he turn? What did he do to avoid the accident? What ultimately was prevented was why the victim might have braked or turned or whatever the way he did, because ultimately it doesn't matter. How he drove had something to do with causation. Why he drove that way had nothing to do with causation. So no matter how you slice it, ultimately it comes up irrelevant or just simply unfairly prejudicial because of its speculative nature.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Thanks to both counsel for your briefing in this matter and your arguments today, responses to our questions. This matter will be taken under advisement and a written opinion will be issued in due course. The court will be in recess until the November 17th oral arguments. Thank you again.
Thank you.